First up now to the next in our series on leadership. Last week I talked to Terry Moran and Linnell Briggs about the challenges to leadership in the public sector. Well, today we hear from a man who says he's well on his way to making his second fortune in the corporate world. And while he claims there's no secret to success, it's simply about putting in the hours, Mark Boris reckons he's been able to build disruptive businesses to challenge the market, and he's notched up 25 years' experience in the finance and property sectors as a result. You might recall his establishment of Wizard Home Loans, one of Australia's largest non-bank lenders, and that company was sold to GE Money in 2004. Well, Mark Boris is now the executive chairman of Yellow Brick Road Wealth Management. He's an adjunct professor for banking and finance and business law and tax at the University of New South Wales Australian School of Business. He also hosts Celebrity Apprentice Australia on TV, and he's written a new book on his business philosophy entitled What It Takes. It's an Allen & Unwin publication. So, Mark Boris, a big pleasure to welcome you to Saturday Extra.
Hi, Geraldine.
Now, you're a TV star, of course, now, and there's a lot of flurry at the front desk when you're here. But I didn't know about your University of New South Wales work. What do you do there?
Well, since 2004, I've taken up an academic role there. I'm also on the Australian School of Business Advisory Council as well. I have a very solid input into that university. I think it's one of the great institutions of this country. I was educated there. I have great affection for the students, great affection for the system, and I wouldn't be where I am today but for that university.
How did you get your start?
Well, I wasn't necessarily some kid from the western suburbs who was desperate and down on his luck. But I did come from parents and a broader family, all of whom were migrants. So it's a bit like I could tell you what to do, you might not do it. But once you see it growing up, you tend to copy it and do it yourself. And that's what I did. I'm fairly industrious as a person, and that's only because that's all I've ever seen in my life.
What were they in? What line of business were they in?
My dad worked in a factory all his life, but it was all him and his brothers always trying to set up new ventures because they couldn't afford not to have the cash flow over their job. But they're always setting up ventures, property ventures, cafes, restaurants, sandwich businesses. They're always coming up with ways to do things outside of work hours and on weekends, trying to make an extra dollar.
How interesting. Now, you've got a formidable work ethic and your average day isn't for the faint-hearted. How many hours would you put in a week as a presumption?
Well, I'd definitely do 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, definitely.
Does it leave room for what people might say is a life? I mean, is this what leadership entails?
Geraldine, that is my life. I don't play golf. I don't go yachting. I don't spend much time at the theatre, although I would like to spend more time at the theatre. I love my rugby league, that's about it, and my children are all grown up. So it is my life, it's what I love doing, and because I am, as you said at the beginning, I'm a disruptive business model builder. I love disruption, and there is an intellect around that, and that intellect around that is being able to show and prove that the model as it is currently and conventionally accepted can be disrupted by another model that someone develops, which is what I do. And that sort of completely captivates me minute by minute of every day.
So you're what, you know, there are two. I heard a very good discussion on this network on Sunday Extra about transactional leaders and transformational leaders. So you'd see yourself very much in the transformational leader mode, would you?
Absolutely. I try to transform whole market segments and change the way they are traditionally done. And now that's a big deal because I'm taking on the big four banks, the four most profitable banks by market capitalization in the world today. I'm trying to say that to the extent you deal with a consumer in financial transactions, I'm trying to change the way that is done as opposed to the traditional way we go and see your bank manager and transact.
And when you reflect, because this book is, and I'm going to get to that in just a moment, full of quite a lot of quite careful reflection on yourself. When you look at the orthodoxy, at the existing situation, do you just start to critique it? I mean, how do you start this process of disruption?
Well, in terms of financial services, it is something that has aggravated me ever since I applied for my first loan. I had to go with my father. I had to go with my dad. My dad had to guarantee it for me at a bank in Miranda. I won't say which bank. In fact, the bank doesn't even exist today. Well, doesn't have the same name. Right there and then, I wasn't upset. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't filthy on the bank, but I just couldn't see the sense in what they were asking to happen. And I guess in the back of my mind, I've been following this problem over a 20-year period whilst I was working in accounting firms and law firms and doing the various things I was doing, which sort of culminates in an opportunity to do something against it, which is what I did. after 15, 16 years of experience. And I had an opportunity to do it, and I saw someone else doing it. I saw a market changing. You know, we had the Campbell Report, Campbell Inquiry, Campbell Report, deregulation of Australian banking system, an opportunity then actually to jump in and change things, and that's how I started the wizard business. And that was off the back of the Campbell Inquiry. Again, GFC, it's a dysfunction. There is a change in the environment. The structure changes. Again, there's another opportunity to do the same thing, which is what Yellow Brick Road does.
You talk on in chapter 20, one of the things you do in this book is you try to really drill down into yourself. And this chapter is called Stepping Away From Yourself. You say that the oracle at Delphi may say, man, know thyself. And this is the beginning point for all things. But the next phase is being able to look at yourself from the outside. What does that mean?
I think with most small business owners who, you know, lead their whole environment, whether they've got 20 employees or 200 employees or 200 employees, they're the leader of their environment. The worst thing that they can do is actually be participants 24 hours a day and 100% of the time in the business, as opposed to observers. What I mean by stepping away from yourself, you cannot be laying down there in the mud, rolling around, wrestling with all the issues day to day of your business, how to fix this, how to fix that, how to do this, and not at the same time create a whole lot of anxiety and stress for yourself.
Well, you say, to give me an analogy, the scientist wants to understand motivation and behaviour, so she sets up a maze with a water dispenser down one end and a red light at the other. She puts a mouse in the maze and watches. You are the mouse, you say. You must also be the scientist. You are the subject, the mouse, and you are also the object, the experiment. That's quite tricky intellectually, yeah. Isn't it? And emotionally.
It's a very important thing emotionally to be able to do. Otherwise, the business will own you, it will envelope you, and you'll become the business. There'll be a problem.
A lot of people might think that is the essence of modern leadership.
Well, I don't think it is. I think the essence of modern leadership is detachment. So you've got to be able to detach yourself from these things, because they're material things you've created. I mean, it's not a real thing. A business is not a real thing. It's something you've created, an environment you've created, and there's a whole lot of things participate in that. So you can be quite critical of it as well. You can say, I didn't go this direction, just like the mouse doesn't in the maze. Mm. And by the way, you're the mouse as well.
And does this mean you have less risk of being crushed? You talk about the whole business of time management and that people feel, especially if they see they're the go-to person, they've got the ideas, they've got the disruptive ideas, and then they become the hub, which I would have thought, you see, was the right way. But you say this is a trap here because people end up being just overburdened. Again, I just wonder how you step back at those crucial moments.
It's something you practice. I actually developed this through my yoga practice over many years, over a 10-year period.
How long have you done yoga?
10 years. Right. So I've learnt this process and this practice. It was something that I did do anyway. You asked me before how many hours a day I work, and people, when they hear that, they go, well, how could you possibly do that? Because I actually, quite a bit of that time, I actually am sitting back reflecting on what I'm doing. That might be just laying down and thinking about in a nice, calm way what it is I've got to do for tomorrow and how I'm going to get over that tomorrow, and how I'm going to deal with all the issues I've got to deal with tomorrow. So that might be included in that 14-hour period, where it might be just sitting still and breathing properly and thinking about what you're about to do.
Does that mean, in reality, that you have someone underneath you who does, who runs the risk of being crushed, who actually does all that? You're being the strategic thinker and there's somebody else making it happen?
I do have a lot of people work for me, that is true. But that's not always been the case in relation to where I start my businesses, particularly this business, Yellow Brick Road, has been started off as a small business. It's big today. Now, I'm one of those people who will do everything if I need to. So I can micromanage, I can macromanage. I do whatever I have
to
do.
But you don't like micromanaging.
I don't really like micromanaging because I'm a strategic thinker. But I think being the strategist in the environment is different to this process of being able to detach yourself. Mm. The detachment process is what you've got to do as a proprietor. That's an ownership issue. That's how you've got to detach yourself from that, one. Two, in terms of being a strategist, I'm probably better at being a strategist than I am as part of the microenvironment, mainly because I'm more efficient. I can get more thoughts out there and get other people to do them for me.
Mark Burris is my guest on Saturday Extra, and he's written a very interesting book called What It Takes. It's his story, but it's really a reflection on the nature of leadership. Interestingly, you're quite honest here. You say that you enjoy standing back and assessing what's happening. You actually enjoy that more than participating with people. Your social skills and social involvement, you say, aren't necessarily a strong suit. You're, if anything, more aloof. Now, how long did it take you to work that out?
It's a lot. It's actually taken me a long time. I'm 57 actually next week. And I would say I probably started to work it out in the last 4 or 5 years. I actually probably am on the other end of the scale. I am not good socially because I probably stand back and observe too much. I'm actually not good at socialising.
You don't have small talk?
I don't understand the purpose of it. I don't understand where we're going to, what it's about, what for. I can do it, but it's more of a performance from my point of view. I do it in the television show. That's what I'm doing in Celebrity Apprentice. I'm sort of performing that. I can do it, yes. Do I do it naturally well? No.
Have you made mistakes on that score? Because, the other thing is that whole business of engagement with staff and being the bridge between them and their dreams, et cetera, et cetera. By the sound of it, you don't really place a high priority on that.
I do place a high priority on it, but I don't put much behind my ability to do it. So right. I make sure I have good people around me who actually deliver on that sort of stuff, pretty much to soften the blow, to make it happen and to smooth things out, not so much for the person on the other side, but to teach me how to do it.
Well, that's candid, at least. You do pay quite a lot of attention to looking after your health, and you do flesh that out. It's part of the burden of leadership, by the sound of it, or the burden of ownership, I think you talk about. And you talk about spirit. You actually label, body, mind, spirit. Business people in particular, Australians in general, hate to talk about spirit, but you think it matters to maintain your spirit in business. Why so?
Well, I said earlier, we are not the thing we are creating. We are more our spirit than we are the business we've created. Too many of us, and it happens to me all the time, I'm always pulling myself back from it, but we tend to believe we are the thing that we're promoting. In other words,
we end up feeling too much, oddly enough.
We look like it. We become the TV executive or the radio executive or the bank executive in every way and everything that it represents and everything that we think it should be. And really, we got to remember our own spirit. I'm not talking about spirituality as such in a religious sense, but your own spirit, the thing that the essence of you, what's important about you. I haven't changed since I was a little boy. I know that in terms of the things I like to do. I'm the same person, the same little boy, but the problem is a lot of us poison ourselves on the way through. We galvanize ourselves into being something else. We can't forget about that person. And that's, in fact, that's the essence of us. That's the spirit of us. That's the most important thing we've got to work on and maintain, because that's what makes us happy.
But you also have to change, don't you? Like, if you do become steadily more successful and people rely on you, there is a certain extra onus on you, is there not?
It's an expectation.
Yes.
If you accept it.
And you're inclined not to?
I accept it in terms of the business parameters of the business that I'm running. If you ask me in a social sense or a personal sense, generally speaking, I won't accept it. So am I expected to wear certain clothes in a certain place all the time? I'm wearing a suit and tie today because that's what's on the book. But if you saw me at any other time, I'll be completely the way I want to be, and I won't do what everybody expects of me.
You do talk about personal development. Again, you say you have to have something you enjoy that has nothing to do with business. What is it for you?
I really do enjoy yoga. I love my yoga. I love boxing. They're totally at each other in a scale, but I do love boxing.
Do you still box, do you?
Yeah, I do. I sparred yesterday on Wednesday morning. So, I get beaten up a lot these days, but that's okay. It's just body sparring, so I can handle that. I love my rugby league, and I love those big stadium events. So I've spent a lot of time in relation to the rugby league, watching it. I'm on the board of the Roosters. I put a lot back into the club. I still go to the boxing ring, go to Woolloomooloo Police Boys regularly, my yoga is really, really important to me.
How often do you do yoga?
I like to do it at least twice a week, right. But I should be doing it 3 times a week.
You say everyone needs a holiday. In fact, I think you take a sabbatical once every 10 years, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
What's a sabbatical mean for you?
It's a complete change of environment. It is no phones, no work, nothing, just doing what you like. And in my case, I like to go somewhere out of the country, completely away from this country. So sabbaticals are incredibly important, and it's got to be like minimum 6 to 8 weeks. Now, it doesn't mean you don't do anything, like in a business sense. You can do things, but you're out of your office, you're out of your environment, and you're not required to do anything. Now, I haven't done it for about 8 years. I wonder whether today it's harder to do with smart devices and access to them, because last time I did it, emails was not a big thing. Smart devices didn't exist. Mobile phones, yes, but texting was sort of just becoming a thing. So I just wonder how easy it will be for me to do this in 2 or 3 years' time.
Interesting experiment. Hmm. You do suggest that the business leader makes sure they mix with creative people, not just the technical specialists of their industry. Why have you come to that conclusion?
I think business success, to the extent you everybody judges it in a different way, but I think creativity is the thing that actually causes success, then the execution is the technical part. You need the creativity skills first, and somebody needs to be sparking your imagination about what you can do. In other words, give you that good idea, but the good idea has to be engineered then. The engineering is totally different to the architecture. The architecture is the creative bit. The engineering is the bit that makes it work. So many people I know have great ideas, can't engineer it.
Mm.
So many people are great engineers, but never ever put that skill into use because they never have the architecture. The two need to meet. And if you're a business leader, you want to sit back with both of those in your environment and get them to work for you.
So these might be people with whom you have very little in common at all, like getting back to your point about being almost a bit aloof. Presumably you don't have a lot of small talk with them, but you just sort of let them take the lead, do you? You just sit and listen?
Yeah, correct. I have them in my businesses. So outside of my financial services business, I'm involved in a technology business. Absolutely. You know, our main projects guy is a well-known structural engineer. He does all the engineering work. I really don't have that much discussion with him outside of what we are talking about. Then I have other people who are ideas people. Unfortunately, my ideas guy actually passed away recently, but he was a brilliant guy. But he could sit there and talk to you and you could never actually work out what he was talking about. And he would talk for hours and hours and hours. But there was a gem in there, and I get the engineering guy to say, I grab him and say, grab that bit of information, that creative bit there, and tell me how we can make an application, an electronic application out of that. And today, we are this particular business I run, which is based in Chicago, is known as one of the best technology businesses in the world, and we recently won a big tender in Singapore for Singapore Post. That came about as a result of me harnessing the creativity of the genius guy and getting the engineering guy to actually put it into some fashion that we could actually make it work.
Semi-last question, I think. What about, there must have been a time when exertion and fatigue did weigh you down, when you just didn't listen to all your own good advice, a bit of a dark night. What can you remember one, and
yeah,
what did you do?
I think I even write about it in the book, but it happened in 2009. I was the chairman of the business, the wizard business that General Electric had bought from me back in 2004. So this is 2009, middle of GFC. GE decided they want to sell. They sold it to my competitor, John Simons, and CBA Bank. What happened? I wasn't looking after myself. I caught whooping cough. It developed into something terrible. I collapsed, ended up in St. Vincent's emergency ward, was told I couldn't work for 3 months, which I didn't listen to. What was the problem? I tell you what the problem was. I believed in my own inability to be beaten or to be defeated, and I never listened to my own body. I never thought for a moment a GFC would come and that someone like the company I work for would ever be affected. And that is the worst mistake you can make. I do talk about in this book, and this is an example where I didn't do it, you must have a certain level of paranoia in business. I don't mean to be paranoid, but you need a level of paranoia where you are constantly asking yourself questions. Can I do this better? Am I in the right industry? Is there going to be something that's going to change? Is there a structural change coming through? What do I do if there is a structural change? Continually asking yourself these questions and talking to yourself. Now, I know that sounds a bit weird, but it works.
It's sort of true risk management, isn't it?
True risk management, real risk management. If you get too comfortable and you don't listen to this sort of advice that I've always talked to myself about and I've always advised others to do, you run into problems. And that actually happened to me in 2009. I was lucky, though. As a result of that, that actually galvanised me into establishing my Yellow Brick Road business. And that's sort of why I wrote this book. Because I know a lot of people have been through those same sort of problems, particularly out of the GFC, particularly in this country. You know, we're famous for beer and sport and doing better in Olympics than everyone else. We should be famous for the number of small business owners we have in this country per capita and how successful they are relative to the rest of the world. Mm. They are the engine room of this country, small business owners.
Mark Burris, it's been a real pleasure to meet you, and thank you very much indeed for swapping The Apprentice and The Apprentice Studios for the ABC. Thanks for coming
in. You're most welcome, Geraldine. Thank you.
Mark is Executive Chairman of Yellow Brick Road Wealth Management. He's Adjunct Professor, as I said, for Banking and Finance and Business Law at University of New South Wales Australian School of Business. And What It Takes is published by Allen and Unwin. Just reminded me, you know, chatting there with Mark of what Terry Moran said after we finished last week, that actually he thinks there's extraordinary capacity for leadership within Australians because of the way our country has been formed. And so people will take up the challenge when it's offered, or maybe not even when it's offered. So interesting perspectives.